Hey, folks, welcome to the new and improved Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Why is it improved? Well, a combination of a lot of factors, but the biggest is that we have left terrestrial radio. It was something that we had been contemplating for some time. The terrestrial radio business is not what it was. In fact, I barely think it exists to a large extent. You're watching sort of a legacy, just even on the right, but certainly on the left. In the years following Air America, it was very difficult. Most of the radio shows that were on were actually making their money. Their revenue was coming from their podcast service. And I, with a lot of regret, with a very heavy heart, because I think radio, terrestrial radio, is one of the most important mediums we have. It reaches the most amount of people in the country. It meets people where they are and during the course of the day and where they live. It also reaches people who of a incredible variety of socio and economic dispositions and class, and it has the most access to people of the working class. But we just couldn't make it work long term. I don't know if we would have made it, but coronavirus made it virtually impossible, both because of what happened with Scott, our producer, who was out of the country when things shut down, and he is in quarantine. That's part of it. Part of it is, frankly, we just don't have the revenue to continue. I am now out of town from a remote location. And frankly, from a work perspective, doing it as a radio show became incredibly onerous. I have to take care of my kids. I don't have a babysitter. And so all these things conspired to make us drop the terrestrial radio part of it. In the meantime, it gives us the opportunity. A lot of people who listen to the podcast complain about, hey, why do you have to do it in 18-minute segments? Why do you have to take a break in 9 minutes? Why do you have to reset? We don't have to do that anymore. It's a pure podcast, and we're going to try and maintain the spirit of what we had with the radio show. The radio show was on for 15 years. We would do a lot of interviews with reporters, a lot of interviews about corporate malfeasance, a lot of issues surrounding climate change and surrounding the pharmaceutical industry and whatnot. We're going to continue to do that. And I don't know if there is another podcast out there that will survey the type of reporters that we do and not necessarily always chase the news of the day or even the news of the week. I mean, we do that recap with Heather Parton, with Digby, every week, and she is one of the most thoughtful writers out there who write on this kind of stuff, one of the original bloggers from back in 2004, and she gives everything a very specific context, a very unique context and insight, which I appreciate. We're going to continue to do that. We're also going to continue to do a couple of interviews with reporters from week to week. We're gearing up. We're still formulating it. But by all means, send us a message on Twitter. You can find us at Ring of Fire Radio on Twitter. Let us know what you think can improve the podcast. Sign up to become a member. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to work this in terms of a free portion of the show and maybe some member content. What we may do is actually put out two separate podcasts during the course of the week. We will see. We haven't quite figured all this out. All of this happened very quickly. So that's where we are. Joining us this week to bring you the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me in just a moment. And we'll go over, you know, the top stories of the week and where we are. It's a very strange time. But enjoy the new show. We will be developing it from here on in if you can afford at this time. And I know a lot of people are going to be hit hard by this. And by all means, do not put yourself in any type of financial stress or jeopardy. But if you can support the program now, it would be very helpful. You can go to rofpodcast.com to support the show. Become a member. We haven't quite worked out what all the benefits are going to be, but there'll be many. So check it out, rofpodcast.com. So quick break. Be right back with Heather Parton, or Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo.
In December, drinking hot chata, I'd look psychotic in a balaclava. Winter's cold is too much to handle. Pinch of crabs, a pinch of your sandals.
So, Heather, it has been a couple of weeks since we've talked. And in many respects, that feels more like years. Things have changed dramatically since that time. I am outside of New York City in a remote studio that I have set up to do my show. Scott Milliken, the producer of Ring of Fire, was trapped overseas for a while and is now in quarantine as he returned back to the country. And you are in a similar mode in California. Both of us are an extreme stay-at-home state. And I think the last we talked might have been right after Super Tuesday, or maybe just before then. And things are very, very different now. And I'm not quite sure where we're at, but I don't know. Give me your. I know you've written a piece in Salon this week that is. I don't want to say omnibus, but it is sort of trying to capture part of this moment. What's your sense of where we're at right now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think you and I did talk about this. I mean, even though, you know, we were sort of splitting, I think the last time we talked, we're talking about the primary and, you know, politics generally, and then talking about the pandemic and, you know, what was going on, and, you know, with a sense of urgency, of course. I mean, we, just like you, you know, I've been thinking about this and writing about this really since I looked back, and I wrote about this in the third week of January. I was writing about the virus on my blog, and sort of putting out, you know, general public service announcements about, you know, what kind of things people needed to have on hand and how this was coming. It seemed pretty clear to me from what I was reading. And, you know, like you, I'm an omnivorous reader. I read everything, and that's my job. So I was aware that this thing was happening. And, you know, you and I have talked about it, and it's been part of it. But as you say, within the last couple of weeks, you know, everything, I think, just shifted. Now, I think for the first time, and this is true for me, even though I was following this closely and knew what a tremendous threat it was, it's this, as we're seeing these hospitals overrun, I mean, for me, it was seeing a story about Italy, in which, you know, obviously a first world country with first world medical care, and there were people lined up, you know, in corridors, and they were going, you know, this isn't an extra ward. These are people, this is the waiting room. This was how they put it on TV. And that just struck, I'm going, oh my God, you know, this is really, it's as bad as the worst, case scenarios were. And I started to feel how serious and how incredibly catastrophic this thing was. And as a political observer, of course, it also hit home in exactly that same moment that we have a leadership that is completely dysfunctional. At best, you'd call it dysfunctional. I mean, I would say at this point, it's, you know, beyond,
right.
You know, equally catastrophic in its ineptitude. And, so, you know, I mean, where I'm at, I'm in Santa Monica. I'm hunkered down. We're on an extreme stay in place order here. We can only go out to a grocery store or, you know, a pharmacy or a doctor's office if that's what we're doing. And I'm just not going out. I mean, I'm staying home. We walk, you know, every day just to get out of the house and get some fresh air, but it's extreme social distancing around here. I talk to my neighbors, you know, across the street. You know, we don't even come into each other's presence much. And even then, it's very quick and we get in and out. So, you know, this is just such a tremendous, you know, change in the way that we are living our lives, and I think how we're looking at our future. And from a political standpoint, the stakes were already high, and they've just gotten to a level where it's almost, you know, the terrifying aspect of it is, you know, I think it must be worse here than it is in other countries where people at least have some remaining trust and faith in their leadership. And, you know, here in America, obviously, at least half the country, you know, has none. I mean, zero. So, you know, we're kind of sitting here hoping that we just kind of get through it. So, I mean, that's where I'm at now, and just trying to kind of write every day and you know, keep my readers informed about what I'm seeing and my impressions of it, and trying to keep up. And I, you know, I feel sorry for people who, you know, are not used to that level of immersion and are looking at it and kind of going, oh my right. dear God, you know, this is terrible. But, you know, you've got to document this stuff, and you have to bear witness when this kind of thing is happening to the best you can. And luckily we do have this new technology. Imagine if this had happened 30 years ago, you know, we would not have right. had the internet. We wouldn't have the ability for you and I to do this, or for us to write and connect with one another, do Zoom or Hangouts or whatever people are doing. So in that sense, you know, technology is kind of the saving grace of this whole thing, that we're able to stay somewhat interconnected, even though we have to isolate ourselves. It's astonishing. You know, I can't believe we're living through it, to be honest. I mean,
no, it is surreal. And in many yeah. respects, it's also sort of the only thing that makes sense with Donald Trump as president. And of course, it's the existence of the coronavirus is going to be a problem regardless. But I don't think that we are really even close to understanding the implications of it, both in terms of what it could mean in terms of a health crisis in this country and then an economic crisis.
Yeah,
I think we're, you know, I mean, in many respects, you know, I would use an analogy of like a tsunami. We had the warning. We saw it was out there. We started to see it come in. And then all of a sudden we are just drowning. And I think we are just like, you know, I've watched those videos of tsunamis that have, you know, have hit. And it's, you know, the first set of videos are people like at the beach and they're scrambling, right, to get into the hotel. And then within hours, you're getting videos from people who are in the middle of the city, and there's water up to the first or second floor of every building. I feel like we're at the beach where yeah. we can see the water coming in, but the real implications are not being felt yet. And I think in some ways it's reflected in the approval ratings that Trump is getting for handling this. I think for a lot of people around the country, the way they're experiencing this is people are shutting down. We're having to stay inside, but they don't know anybody who's, you know, maybe we're starting to see some people lose their jobs in their communities, but they don't know anybody who's died. They don't know anybody who's sick. And I can tell you, because of both my close sort of physical proximity to New York, the fact that I live in there, that's where I live, and I still have friends in the city. What's happening in New York is stunning, and it's only yeah. going to get worse. And I think that there is, I mean, hope springs eternal, and there is no other, there's nothing to even sort of, create the sort of the emotional memory of New York or sense of it. But I'm afraid that we're going to get clusters of this around the country that are going to be reminiscent of this. Smaller cities, mid-sized cities that just,
yep.
boom, it happens to hit there. And, you know, I think there's a lag time. I have a feeling we could be a couple of weeks out from that happening. You know, a lot of people from around the country come into New York, and there's a high density, so it spreads more quickly. But I think we're going to get little pockets of this. People come back from spring break from Florida, where people were gathering on the beaches. You know, they say New Orleans could be an epicenter, and a lot of people travel to New Orleans, and then they come home. And then now I think, you know, we'll see what happens in the next couple of days. And I think this is going to be a real problem from a health perspective. And that may raise the stakes for people. And then we're going to get hit with, I mean, we had 3.5 million people file for unemployment insurance. And they filed last week.
Yep.
We're recording this on Thursday. These are all from the end of these are all from last week. We have not seen this week's numbers yet, which I think we have reason to believe is going to be double. We're already talking something that's like 3 to 4 times more than we've seen in the past last week. I think this week we're going to break that record by twice. So we're talking about from this crisis, a single week that will be 4, 5, 6, 7 times the greatest loss of jobs recorded in a single week in this country. And the implications of that, I think, are going to be, I don't even know how we can assess these things, because it's not like we're going to get to a point in a week or two where it's like, okay, this is over, everybody walks out. This is still going to be floating around. Even if we get to the point where we're not having the crises that we anticipate in the hospitals, right? Where the deaths, there's a certain amount of death rate. And, you know, for a while in the States, we were seeing like, oh, the death rate is like, you know, 0.7% or something, which is still, you know, 4 or 5 times higher than the flu, but it's not a problem. But at one point you get to a threshold where you have enough people who are ill that the death rate is a function of hospitals being unable to treat people. And that's when the death rate is going to become exponential.
That's right.
And in New York, in New York, we're very close to that, I think. And, you know, we could be a couple of days away from that, that element of this happening. But when you talk about a small city, they have a limited number of ICU beds, and it, you know, the coronavirus doesn't care. If there's a cluster of people that get it and react in the worst way to it, I mean, we could be seeing some real continuing tragedies across the country. And so I think we are very much at the beginning of this. I don't think we have a sense of what really the next 2 or 3 months, or frankly, the next 6 months, or conceivably the next 9 to 18 months even look like. You know, 18 months is, you know, when we, I think we can anticipate, you know, somewhere between 12 and 18 months is where we can anticipate some measure of treatments or vaccination or something to that effect. But prior to that, it's very hard to anticipate what's going to happen. And it's also, you know, like that's, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about this, but the long-term implications of this, like, and we can talk about the stimulus too. But the long-term implications of this, the stimulus aside, of how it's going to restructure society in the way that people work, in the way that people, you know, I mean, my kids are 14 and 7, and this is going, this is, I certainly as a kid never had an experience like this, and I don't think you did either. That became sort of a defining experience of our lives in some way. And I think for my kids, this could very well be one of those type of experiences.
It's like World War II or the Great Depression. I mean, there are some things that are so huge. And it's in this case, this is something that just happened abruptly. I mean, you know, from any kind of historical standpoint, this happened in a millisecond, right? I mean, it was just boom. And everything stopped and everything, you know, people started to, you know, be in a completely different, you know, way of life. And it's going to be that way for a while. I mean, as much as Donald Trump thinks that everything's going to be over by Easter, or is wishing that everything would be over
to,
by Easter, that's completely absurd. I mean, that's not going to happen. And in fact, this is one of the big problems here, and is that Trump from the very beginning. I mean, this has been discussed ad nauseum, but I think it's important to keep this, fresh in people's minds that, he was warned by the intelligence community. He had plenty of information that this was happening. He refused to see it. He had a number of things that he felt were more important. He had a trade deal with China, which made him unwilling at first to, take it seriously. He had his coming reelection. There's the economic aspects of it, and he blew it off. He did. And he refused to listen to the people. His HHS secretary, Azar, tried to get in there to talk to him, and he had people like Kellyanne Conway stopping him and saying, no, this,
and can we say
this
that
isn't present. Sorry.
When Azar, I mean, this is just one of those like little factoids that is fascinating to me in the reporting. When Azar finally got in to talk to him about this, he got on the phone, and I think it was around the second week of January.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Trump interrupted him to ask him where they were on vaping and if flavored vaping was going to return, because he felt he was getting killed politically by the absence of flavored vaping. This is in the middle of Azar giving him briefing on a coming pandemic.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. I mean, that was the way that's how they were looking at this. And it wasn't just him. There were people around him who were also saying this doesn't reach presidential level. I mean, can you imagine that? Kellyanne Conway and the rest of them, they were saying, keep it away from him. And, then let's not deal with that. Although at the time, weirdly enough, there were people in the right-wing media who were talking about the pandemic and saying that they wanted to end impeachment, which was happening at that time, because they wanted the president to deal with the pandemic. So this was, a very, very strange moment that was going on. But, we know beyond that there were, through this entire thing up until now, Trump has at every step refused to listen to the people who were telling him the truth. And in my view, I think in a lot of ways, he just simply doesn't understand it. It's clear from the way he talks that he hasn't really grappled with something like, exponential growth of something like a virus or how he could use his power. I mean, this is a guy who was out there claiming just a few months ago, I can do anything I want. I have an Article 2, he said, and here he is now. He has power under the Defense Production Act, that he could be taking control of the industries that temporary control of the industries that make medical supplies, and take that over and then be in charge of coordinating and distributing those things to where they're needed. Instead, he's been convinced by his business buddies that that's unnecessary, and basically they're running, a price war among states and localities and the feds.
And internationally.
It's like an
eBay auction. And so you're basically just, it is basically the Chamber of Commerce saying to Trump, we've got some price gouging to do here. And there's money to be made. I mean, let's go back if we could. And I've seen some very, I think, well done videos that give a sort of a timeline, and you can see Trump, saying this is no big deal and on and on. But really the story starts, it seems to me, almost after he is elected and John Bolton comes in. Maybe this is about 8-9 months into it at the NSC. And Bolton and Trump are responsible for essentially decapitating the apparatus that we had in this country to deal with pandemic response. Yep. And so he takes out the top pandemic, coordinator who sat on the National Security Council. I believe he was a former admiral or general or something to that effect. And with the removal of this guy from the National Security Council and firing essentially from the government, so too did his whole team, which would have coordinated the disparate government responses to a pandemic. Subsequent to that, they fired the CDC representative in China who would monitor for pandemics. Now, this is going to sound like they set this whole thing up to have a pandemic. We don't know, because it hasn't hit, what other places we are vulnerable. They just took a hatchet to everything and just swung wildly at this stuff. We know now that there was, in fact, an NSC playbook that was designed by that team, literally a playbook that you could just open up and read and say, oh, the, you know, we need to deal with this. This is what need. They never looked at it. They didn't care. The strategy seemed to be, let's believe this thing's going to blow over. And so there is no reason to spend any political capital or physical capital or resource capital. We should just avoid dealing with this whatsoever. And there is no masks. There are no ventilators. There are no expanded hospitals. There is no plan to inform different municipalities. You need to shut your schools. There is nothing that exists in preparation for this until it's too late, essentially. There's no testing. And then we should also say, once this hits, they reject the tests that both the World Health Organization formula and physical tests that could have been provided by the Germans. And I'm quite convinced that the reason why they did that is because Donald Trump had somebody who was going to make some cash from it. Absolutely. Like, I don't know who it was, but that's what it smells like to me. It's like, wait a second.
Some kind of patent thing or something, you know, that they didn't want to, they wanted to own the patent on the test or some other nonsense like that. I mean, that really was the second phase, this phase of the complete lack, the breakdown at the CDC, in which they made a test that didn't work. There was a decision they wouldn't use the test that did work. And, you know, some of this goes again, Sam, to an ongoing crisis within the executive branch of Trump hiring incompetent people to run the various agencies. I mean, that was part of that. That's actually a feature, not a bug. You know, I mean, these were things that he didn't know what he was doing. And so he had these people coming in, and they put this guy Redfield in charge of the CDC. And this had been after the person they originally named had been, you know, caught up in some corruption scandal, as usual. So they put this guy Redfield in there. Well, Redfield turns out to be, I mean, he is, a Christian right crusader. He is a virologist, or I guess he's an immunologist. And he's, you know, he's not unqualified to do this job, but he has, you know, he's a political, ideological person, not an objective scientist who's just looking at this. He had reason to try and please Trump. He had reason to try and kind of go along with the crowd. And he's a person, he was involved in all the HIV wars back in the 80s and 90s. He had his own, this is one reason why I think the CDC thing was maybe dicey on the patent ownership level. He was involved with a company that came up with an HIV cure that, of course, was not real. And he actually got sanctioned for that because he had a financial stake in it, and he pushed it hard, and it turned out that it was, you know, snake oil, basically. So there's a little history there, right, that kind of would lead one to believe that there was kind of the idea that maybe the CDC or somehow somebody was going to make some money on this thing. And all that stuff will come out in the wash. But you know, across the executive branch, you've had incompetence at every level. We've seen that over and over again. And in this case, of course, it's been a catastrophe. I mean, we have, you know, the CDC made a huge error in the testing. They screwed it up, and there was actually ProPublica came out with a report just today about the fact that it was way more chaotic at the CDC than we knew. And there were people, you know, begging, they couldn't get the right information, the data was lost, they couldn't find the forms. I mean, this is really bad. Yep. And, you know, maybe that would have happened in another administration. I don't know, but it didn't. We had other pandemic issues happen before. We had H1N1, we had SARS, we had other things. Nothing like this happened, where the CDC just turned out to be just completely incompetent in the face of doing their job.
I mean, let's go back to 2017. Steve Bannon goes to CPAC. What does he say is the agenda of this administration? It is the destruction of the administrative state. And yep. I got some news for folks. the CDC is part of the administrative state. And, you know, some of it, maybe, you know, maybe you get lucky. Maybe you get through 4 years and there is no pandemic. If we, if there hadn't been, if this takes place, you know, February of 2021, maybe it's, you know, President, I don't know, Biden, Cuomo, Sanders, who knows? Rashida Tlaib. I mean, who knows what could happen over the next 6 months? or maybe it's President Trump. But if it's not Donald Trump, then he got by and nobody noticed that they had completely destroyed the apparatus. But they came in with the agenda of destroying the administrative state. And they certainly have, I think, achieved a huge part of that. And that's what we're seeing. All right, let's shift just a little bit because, I mean, I think we also have a, you know, we have this question of Donald Trump, and I think this is a good thing to sort of pivot around a little bit because I think this week it was his highest approval rating in Gallup. This week also saw him get over 50% approval rate in the way that he's handling this. I think part of it is what we just spoke about, the idea that from a health perspective, it has not hit the rest of the country in the way that it probably will, or at least certain parts of the country. From an economic perspective, I don't think that people are, I think we're still close enough to the idea, you know, people lost their job, 3.5 million lost their job a week ago. I think this time next week, we're going to say, another 6 million lost their job a week ago. But once we start saying 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago, Then we're going to be talking about like, wow, a lot of people are starting to hurt. 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks out, then we've got real problems. They passed the stimulus. I want to get to that in a bit, but one of the other things I think that is going on with Donald Trump getting good sort of notices on this and ratings is that there has been a real breakdown, it seems to me, in the Democratic Party functioning as an opposition party. I mean, in many respects, it seems to me to echo what you and I watched in the wake of 9/11, which is a temerity. Even in the face of Donald Trump, who theoretically, you know, should embolden some people. But if you can tell me, I mean, you know, Donald Trump's out there every day giving these speeches. And maybe we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The Democrats need somebody to come out and provide some type of other narrative other than the one that Donald Trump is putting out there that are so part and parcel full of lies. I mean, and you would imagine that that person would be Joe Biden. He is the presumptive nominee of the party. And, you know, about a week ago on the Majority Report, I was calling for him to go out and do daily briefings. Bring Ron Klain. If you got to do it through Zoom, do it through Zoom. And have Klain go through, you know, more or less what the president said the day before and assess things and explain things and say what is right and what is wrong and what we should be doing and what we should be doing for the stimulus bill. And is it presumptuous of him to do it? Yes, but by all means, that's what a leader does. Step out and be presumptuous. Say, I'm going to take it on me. And it seems to me we have a complete absence of that person. Maybe it shouldn't be Joe Biden. Maybe it should be, I don't know, Chuck Schumer. I mean, somebody should be going out every day and doing this.
It should be Biden, but he should be emceeing it, you know, kind of the way Trump does, you know, little intro. Then you bring on Klain one day, you bring in Jared Bernstein another day, you bring in, you know, Austin Goolsbee. I mean, I don't know, you know, whoever. You could bring in Larry Summers. He's actually been sounding pretty, you know, smart lately. I mean, whatever. You just, you
it doesn't even matter. There should be access. You should have access to experts on all of this.
Anybody. And, yeah, absolutely. And there are plenty of them. And there are people, we see them sort of, you know, on the various shows. They're on, you know, sort of saying it for, they've got their little 30-second segment or whatever. But I mean a real structured kind of,
yes,
presentation where Biden doesn't have to say much other than give some comforting words in the beginning and talk about, you know, do the sort of Andrew Cuomo style, you know, kind of lugubrious, you know,
right,
presentation, and give, you know, be the comforter in chief. And he's good at that, actually. I mean, that's the best thing that he does. And then have these, and then say, you know, and I want to turn this over to Ron Klain. I want to talk about, you know, just, this is what we should be doing. This is what, these are the facts, and this is what should happen. And we'll all sit there and go, oh my God, why isn't that happening? But that's okay. Because, you know, that critique of Trump is just extremely important to get out there, because without that, what you have is people just desperate to hear that somebody's doing something.
Exactly.
And that's kind
some
of
voice
why
of
he's
authority.
Getting,
yeah. Of course.
And
there's
yeah,
one narrative, and
you know,
he's getting control of it.
Yeah, he's running the narrative, and they get, you know, they have their, it's a rally that he stages every day for his,
yep,
for his conferences. He, it's, you know, I'm calling them the coronavirus campaign rallies. And you know, he's using that, he goes after the press, he does all this, the usual stuff to, you know, sort of keep his cult members happy. But he's also putting out a tremendous amount of misinformation, dangerous stuff. This stuff about the malaria drug, you know, you've got doctors hoarding that drug now. Fox News viewing doctors who are writing prescriptions for their own families, hoarding it. And the people who need it that have lupus,
right,
and various other, you know, diseases that treats, they can't get it. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that's just crazy making, right? That you've got a president who's out there doing that. But that is going to happen. We can't stop it. I do think the networks should not cover him the way that they do. I think that that's destructive. They should, you know, they should just tape it and then, you know, show segments of it and,
right,
with, you know, criticism following it. But that's not the same thing as sort of having a shadow government there, which is what we need, that says, you know, look, help is on the way. I mean, that's basically all that we're talking about here, is just saying, look, help is on the way. Real people are out here that know what they're doing, that understand what's happening, and we're going to, you know, and I've gathered them all around me, and these are people who are going to be able to step in as soon as, you know, as we can get rid of Donald Trump. And part of the problem is that, as you said earlier, this isn't going to end immediately. I mean, this is a pipe dream. Until they get a vaccine, which could take 18 months, we may be dealing with waves of this. You're already seeing that happen in some of the other countries. Hong Kong's having a new resurgence. We don't know what's going on in China, but that could be happening too. And we just don't know. And our testing scheme is so bad that we don't know who may have had it and has immunity to it and who doesn't. You know, I mean, this is going to be a very confusing 18 months, or at least until they get this vaccine and can manufacture it. So the idea that you've got a government in waiting that is ready to step in, and, you know, needless to say, this isn't going to be the last pandemic. You know, this isn't going to be the last virus like this. I mean, this can happen at any time. We live in a very, very close-knit, you know, global society now, where people are flying all over the country, and these kinds of viruses are going to happen. So there has to be, you know, the sense that we know what we're doing, and, you know, that there's nothing in Trump that says that. But I can understand why people are kind of looking at it going, well, you know, he's got Fauci up there.
He's the one who's up there.
You know, I mean,
There's no counterbalance. There's no narrative that would tell them other than he's in charge and he's know what he's doing. And frankly, like, I am just shocked at Biden's failure to do this. I mean, and to do it well. There's a lack of nimbleness amongst his campaign. I mean, look, I have a very close relationship to the idea of the technical difficulties of streaming, but I imagine his internet is more robust. I imagine he has access to more of revenue
funds and individuals who could set this up.
They could build him a set, right? They could build it for him ground up in a warehouse somewhere.
Or in his garage, or just in a hut on his property. I mean, there's so many solutions to this that should take about 3 days. Or you could just do it on Zoom. I mean, it is very, very disconcerting. And apparently he got a live stream up sometime this week and had 2,800 viewers watching it. And,
yeah, that's crazy.
It is nerve wracking. It's very distressing. And I don't know what to do about it. But, and what would have been nice would have been to have a presidential candidate getting out there and sort of like being on the forefront of the response, maybe coordinating, some type of message about the stimulus. We got a couple of minutes left. Let's just talk about the stimulus. I spoke to David Dayen on the Majority Report yesterday, today. And from his perspective, basically what it is it's not even so much that this is insufficient. Well, there's probably people are going to come back for a second bite at the apple. What it is I think the analogy that I think best sums this up is that in many respects, from an economic standpoint, everybody is now driving under the yellow flag, right? We're at the Daytona 500, and there's been a three-car pileup, and everybody is now flying under the yellow flag. And the government has come in and basically said, you three cars, you represent corporate America, we are going to put you under the green flag. Everybody else, you're still under the yellow flag. We're going to keep, we're going to get you maybe, we're going to get you 80% of the way there, maybe over the next couple of months, maybe. But what we're going to do is we're going to give 400% to these three vehicles, and they're going to start to lap you. And so that when we get to the end of this, when the Great Depression is over or the Great Recession or, never mind the coronavirus crisis in and of itself, we're going to be living in a much different America and a much different economy. And it's going to take all the worst attributes of the economy that we had a month ago and put it on overdrive. I mean, we're already going to see the failure of like small businesses. We're going to see foreclosures. We're going to see bankruptcies. And we're going to be creating an enormous amount of wealth disparity because, the fact that these are loans, we're taking up a $400 billion, and that money is going into almost like a bank, if you will, run by the Fed. That $400 billion becomes the capital reserves that the bank has. They're going to be, 10%. They're going to keep capital reserves of 10%, which is, considered good. But the Fed's going to go out and it's going to loan $4 trillion. And they're going to do it basically at 0%. They're going to give these people this money for an extended period of time. They'll pay it back. But, the reality is, Digby, if somebody gives you $1 million a loan for a year at 0%, you could go around and find the least profitable investment vehicle there is and you could still walk away with $20,000, $50,000 at the end of that year and then give the money back. Well, this is, multiply that by 1,000 essentially, and that's what's happening. We're basically choosing a certain sector of our economy, the corporations, the big ones, not the little ones, not the small businesses, but the big ones, and saying, go to town, go make a ton of money, go make investments, go buy stuff up, gobble up the small businesses, that small Italian restaurant that's going to close on the corner of the street. Put in Olive Garden, but put in some, chain restaurant that is owned by a huge hedge fund. I mean, this is what's happening. We are not helping the people who need it, and we're helping a certain segment of society that are going to continue to inflict pain, economic pain, for years to come.
Well, it reminds me of, obviously, we went through something it's not wasn't like this, but it had some similar features in 2008, obviously. And I remember writing over and over again as we watched this, you know, you remember the Wall Street guys who were all whining because they didn't get their bonuses, and I worked so hard, and look at me, I worked for that $750,000 bonus that I was supposed to get. And I remember writing at the time, you know, like when you let the market... The stock market becomes a god, and that's what we're talking about here. And this god, from time to time, seems to require human sacrifices. And I remember thinking about it back then and always kind of writing this analogy about human sacrifice required. Well, now we're in a situation where the market, this is all about the market, of course. I mean, that's why they are propping up corporations, right? They're afraid them, you know, they want the market to be happy. They're literally talking about human sacrifices now. I mean, we have this thing where Trump said we've got to open up the economy and we've got to get that going. This country has to go back to work. And all these people are kind of coming out of the woodwork saying, well, you know, yeah, some people could die. Maybe the older people should die to sacrifice for the American economy, for their grandkids, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, this it has now turned into kind of a literal thing. I was a metaphor before, and now it is for real. And so you're seeing this, you know, I mean, this worship of the market, which, you know, if had we dealt with the 2008 crisis the proper way, I think, and you and I have talked about that many times, and we were writing about it and talking about it at the time. Had we dealt with that crisis and this worship of the market and this kind of, you know, unreal sort of you know reverence for that part of the economy, for that being the driver, for that being everything, you know, we might have wrung some of that out of our system, but we didn't. We propped them up then, so that was the default. You know, I mean, I think your metaphor is really good of going around the NASCAR race there, because that's exactly what happened before. You know, sure, we'll get a little stimulus here, we'll send some checks out, we'll get some payroll, you know, tax holiday, we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll do whatever. I mean, this is in a much more extreme and emergency that needs to be dealt with instantly. But it's the same thing. It's that same kind of, you know, well, if we just get these corporations healthy and make sure that they can, you know, big business, we can get that, you know, that taken care of, that'll take care of everything, because that's what the backbone of our economy. And of course, it's not true. You know, the backbone of the economy is the workers and the consumers, you know, I mean, it's the people. And so here we are again. And yep. I don't know what will happen. I mean, they keep talking about coming back, you know, doing a second, maybe third bite at the apple. They're going to have to, I think.
Of
course. But whether or not it's sufficient, I don't know. I mean, you know, this cannot be the end of it. And, you know, this is one of those things, too. You know, I mean, you and I, I'm sure you've talked a lot about MMT and all the stuff about deficits and stuff over the last few months, and I'm no expert in that. But, you know, I keep hearing people go, oh, my God, the deficit, the debt, you know, we're going to add all this debt. And I'm like, no, we're going to print money, and that's just fine. That's the beauty of who we are. I mean, if you want to say America is exceptional, that is the way that we are.
We have control over our currency in a way that no one else does. Well, we're going to have a lot more to talk about, Heather, and I appreciate your perspective on this. And thanks for taking the time today. And we will do this again next week.
Okay. My pleasure, Sam. Take care.
You too.
Stay too.
Stay
socially
safe.
Distant.
Indeed.
All right.
All right, Heather. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Want to thank Digby again for helping us week in, week out, analyze the news everyone should know and pay attention to with analysis that, like I said up at the top of the show, incredibly unique. If you're listening to the free one-hour podcast, and this week that's all we have, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can find some over at Ring of Fire Radio, or I should say Ring of Fire YouTube. You can watch Farron do some interviews. You can also catch some of the work that we do over at the Sam Cedar YouTube. You can also listen to my daily show, The Majority Report. You can check it out at majority.fm. I do a daily live stream at noon.
It's available as a podcast later in the day. Also, the AM Quickie. You want every day 5 or 6 minutes of headline news from a leftist perspective? Check it out, amquickie.com. It's completely free. You can go to amquickie.com to sign up, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever. So check it out. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio. Thanks so much for your support. You can get more at rofpodcast.com. See you next week.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.